Hello, and welcome to episode 14 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that man. My name is Graham Lee. This episode is about package managers and the idea of ownership of the software that gets distributed on a system. Now, obviously, there are a lot of different package managers and systems in the world. What I want to do is to kind of talk about a continuum of possibilities. I'm going to use representative examples from across that continuum. So I've actually got four different examples in mind. The continuum I'm thinking about is whether the packages are owned by the by the packaging system, whether the packaging system is installing parts of an overall system that is sort of centrally designed, controlled, or at least groomed and maintained by a team of people or an organization, or whether the packaging system is a tool for other people to get their bits onto the people's computers, whether it's a medium by which many people can distribute packages to many people. And on the face of it, it sounds like this is a sort of cathedral versus a bazaar thing. You know, something like Windows would have maybe a bunch of packages for the different components in its installation. That's definitely how operating systems like Solaris work. And that, so taking the example of Solaris, Oracle would distribute packages for various components that are all part of the Solaris operating environment, and you would expect them all to work together because they've all been tested and optimized for compatibility with the other parts of the Solaris operating environment. But at the other end, you would expect the sort of bizarre model, the open source model, where people can donate whatever packages they want, and then the users, so the people who are using like the package repository and installing packages from this system, can choose whatever packages they want and can build their own system out of it. Actually, the distinction is not clear cut along those lines, and the example I've picked for the what we're thinking of as the cathedral end, so one that's very similar to that sort of Solaris way of working, is the Debian package system, which is DPKG packaging tools, the Deb packaging installer, but then the front ends to that, like apt-get, apt-cache, which is the advanced packaging tool, and then the collection of packages that are on the repository. These are actually effectively owned by Debian, an organization that delivers the Debian distribution, but Debian is really this sort of integrated operating environment that's composed of all of these packages. Of course, the source code that builds the products that are in those packages comes from many different projects and many different upstream providers. But when a package goes into Debian, it's effectively owned by the Debian project. And so they are willing to like make patches so that their version has compatibility fixes that make it work better with other Debian components. Everything that's in Debian should work with anything else you get from Debian. And also there'll be some consistency among the packages, like where files are located on the file system. Packages in Debian should all use the same sort of locations for their configuration files, for their manual pages, for any dynamic libraries they create. And really that is like owned by Debian. So if you install, say, Chromium from the Debian distribution from the repository for the Debian distribution you're using, you should get Debian's version of the Chromium browser, not Google's version of it. And it should be one that works well with the Debian system, whether or not that needed Debian developers or packages to create any patches on top of the upstream source. There's a sort of guarantee that you're getting like the version from the provider. And then the BSD package port systems work much like this as well. They've got their own like versions of the source with their own patches, and they build packages from those. And in each case, you'd get some consistency in which compiler flags are used, which security settings are used when the compiler builds the tools that go into the package. So you know, if Debian decides to turn on address sanitization, that would be turned on across all of their packages, and there would then be a bug fixing activity to go through and correct any errors that are reported by the address sanitization tool, for example, so that when you've got a collection of packages that are all consistently within that release of Debian, then they've all got that same level of address sanitization. That's the theory behind Debian anyway, but because like that is more convenient for users than it is for developers. Developers have a lot more work to get their product into Debian because they have to either spend the time maintaining a Debian package themselves within the Debian project, or negotiate with people on the Debian project to accept that responsibility and to create the package for them. So this idea came along, really sort of popularized by Ubuntu, which is itself in some ways a layer on top of the Debian operating system, of adding like portable package archives or adding your own repositories to the sources.list file in your Debian operating system, so that you're retrieving packages from multiple upstream repositories. And of course now you're hoping that those repositories are all consistent, and if you've got, say, Visual Code from Microsoft's apt repository, and you've got Docker Community Edition from Docker's repository, and you've got Debian Jesse from Debian's repository, then you would hope that you can use that version of Visual Studio Code, that version of Docker, and that version of Debian together. But now you've sort of distributed the trust for all of those things working together across multiple sources. And if one of those third-party components depends on a particular version of a library, and they distribute that version of that library on their own repository, and you end up with that rather than the version that's in the Debian repository, then you're kind of hoping that all of your Debian packages still work with that other version of the library that didn't come from Debian, but it came from someone else. So even though that seems like a very sort of cathedral way of working, actually like a good archetype for it is a bizarre project. It's a it's the Debian distribution. So the second one I want to look at is Homebrew. Now I'm going to come clean at the front of this section and say that I don't like a lot of the design choices in Homebrew. It's very much optimized for a single user computer where that user is an administrator. And that was not how I got into Mac usage, because I was a systems administrator. So I had my unprivileged user that I did my general work in, because that's a good separation of privileges. It's a good sort of security practice. And then I had my administration user that I rarely used to maintain the network of computers. And then I also had hundreds of other users who all had accounts on the same Macs that I was controlling. And that's how a lot of other Unix systems would typically be set up as well. And the homebrew thing expects not only do you have a single user, but that they are an administrator. So if you want to do something as root, you just ask that person for their sudo password. If you want to write to a shared part of the file system, then you just give that admin user write access to that folder. And you know, that kind of worries me. Partly it's just not going to work if you have multiple users, and particularly if you have multiple people to whom you've delegated different subsets of admin rights. You might have a situation where the systems administrator, but also a group of developers, are allowed to install tools in user local, and that so a bunch of other users are able to use the computer and don't have that permission. Well, the homebrew's idea of having the user local area owned by the user who installed homebrew is going to make it very hard, if it is indeed possible, to work in that context. But homebrew takes a sort of halfway house, where there is an upstream source. Yeah, there is like the homebrew repository, which has all of the recipes in it, but that they are not necessarily owned in any way by the homebrew project. They are like pull requests that were contributed by other people and that meet some some standard, some quality idea for getting integrated into the system. But also it has this idea of casks, so other people can have their own versions of packages, and you tap someone else's supply in order to add their collection of packages to the view that the homebrew tools sees. So it's a much more distributed system, even though there's like a central point of access and a very sort of flat way of viewing all of these different packages from different people. And so, you know, it makes it harder to gauge the compatibility between various projects. You know, maybe everyone in the world depends on Image Magic, but the person who's delivering the Image Magic package doesn't regularly communicate with the person who's delivering any of the things that depend on it. And so we don't know whether they're keeping the versions in sync. We don't know whether the patches that are in, if indeed there are any patches in the homebrew version of Image Magic, are compatible with the patches in the homebrew version of other tools that use it. But there is a sort of centralized experience, so everything is installed together in the same place in a, well, fairly consistent way, although it has these kegs that are sort of standalone, and then the cellar where stuff gets installed and then symlinked out into somewhere else, and then there are applications that go into applications and not into the cellar. You know, so it's not like a very consistent system, but a lot of that is working with the conventions of macOS 10 and the fact that macOS 10 has its Unix sort of system and its Unix tools that have a reasonably standard Unix file system layout. Not that there is really a standard Unix file system layout, but a fairly conventional one. And then it has like its applications area and its library area for configuration and so on. And so it's trying to work with these two conflicting expectations. But really, homebrew feels like it's an installer for other people's tools. It's not really a consistent system that is owned and distributed by one project. So then we move almost to the other end of the spectrum, to a very sort of bizarre style. That's bizarre as in a marketplace, not bizarre as in weird. To a very bizarre-like system, which is Flatpak. Now, I could have used Snap, I could use Flatpak. Someone will probably come up with a similar system based on Docker within the next week or so. But this idea that we actually, we don't know what's going on your operating system, and rather than like take that control away from you, or which is well, that's basically what Debian is doing. Debian is saying, if you install only stuff from the Debian package set and allow us to maintain that stuff, then you can do whatever you want on top, but we will look after the operating system for you. The other way, the Flatpak way, says we assume that you are running your operating system however you want, and we have no opinion on that, but it also means we don't trust that everything that we want is there. We don't trust that you have services configured in a way that will let our application run. We don't trust that you have dynamic libraries or shared objects that are compatible with the expectations of our product. Therefore, what we're going to do is essentially distribute a sort of an enclosed environment or a container that has everything that our application needs to run on top of your operating system kernel, or maybe your operating system kernel and your C library, so that as long as you can execute a main function, we'll take over everything else. And we'll have a little partitioned area of the file system that's controlled for storing our configuration files and our data and our executables. And you get to do whatever you want on your file system, but we get to do whatever we want within this file system. And we'll distribute our libraries, so you can have whatever libraries you want on your computer, and we'll have our versions of the libraries that we need. I mean, it means that like interoperability between packages is very good by definition, because you can install any two Flatpaks and they will both work, because they both get their own sort of slice of the operating system. Now, obviously, if you installed, say, Apache and Nginx, only one of them could access port 443 on the host system, so only one of them could serve a HTTPS protocol out onto like any one public interface. But there's no reason that you couldn't have it configured on for both on two different interfaces, or have them both looking at their own port 443 that are then forwarded to different ports on the host operating system. You know, essentially they're kind of isolated from the rest of the computer, which also means that there's no interoperability. You have to explicitly share information between them, and they have to between different packages on the system, and they have to have explicit ways for doing that, which is great from a security perspective and from a sort of trustworthiness perspective. You're not going to like do anything deliberate or accidental, malicious or benign, that is going to interrupt the execution of this program. It's going to get data in ways it expects. It's going to give out data in ways it expects. It's, you know, it's going to work. It means that like maintenance and upgrade paths for any individual package are entirely down to the provider. You just deliver whatever you need to get from one version to another. So, you know, an example is I use the Snap Store to maintain a Nextcloud, which is like a sort of hosted iCloud or, you know, Dropbox plus a ton of features type of system, a free software but one. And the Snap will upgrade, because the way that the database structure works on Nextcloud is that any minor version can update to another minor version within that major release, but you have to get to the final revision of a major release before you can go to the next major release. So if there was like 17.1, 17.2, 17.3 and 18, and you were on 17.1, you would have to get to 17.3 before you get to 18. Well, the Snap can take care of that. It can know what the valid upgrade paths are, and it can run through that collection of upgrade scenarios without worrying that anything it does in the meantime is going to disrupt the rest of the operating system or the other tools that are installed on the same host, because the Snap is entirely standalone. It's completely, like, all of its dependencies are self-contained. So it's very similar to a container model that you might get with Docker or Singularity or any of those tools. And my final example is kind of like homebrew or flatpak, but more so, well, more like homebrew than more, but more so, it's the language specific package repositories, which is a thing that I've never really understood. So the first one that I ever used was the Comprehensive Tech Archive Network, CTAN, which was a collection of modules that you could use with your tech documents or LaTeX documents. The Comprehensive Perl Archive Network, CPAN, was based on that, and that was a collection of Perl modules that you could fetch and install. But there, you know, every programming language these days has its own version of this. So Rust has its crates, Go has whatever the Go one is called, GoGet. JavaScript has npm, Python has numerous systems, pip, conda, and PyPy, and so on. I can pick on any of these, but you know, let's pick on npm. Like, it's really, the commonality is the programming language in which these things are implemented, and that shouldn't really be a concern for anybody. You know, a user should use a package based on the facilities it provides, or the value it gives them, or the like efficiency they get from adding it to their workflow, or the fun they get from playing their game, or whatever it is. But there shouldn't be any reason to choose based on implementation language. But I'd also say that like developers shouldn't choose based on implementation language either, because like, you know, if the problem has been solved and you can use the solution from whatever programming language you're writing in, then the problem is solved and you have access to the solution. Like, every time one of these new environments spins up, there's then a sort of land grab while people get the basic functionality that's already available in all of the other systems. They re-implemented it in this new language and redistribute it as a Ruby gem instead of as a Perl module, or as a npm package instead of as an Erlang function, or what, you know, whatever it is. It would be like, it seems to me that it would be more efficient to spin up a system where you rely on foreign function interfaces and being able to call existing implementations of common algorithms, rather than like re-implementing those algorithms from scratch in every language. That has the trade-off that if you've got someone who's a language expert, you know, in a particular language, we looked previously at the chief programmer team, or the sort of surgeon team idea from Fred Brooks' Mythical Man Month. If you had like someone who was the language lawyer on that team for JavaScript, say, and an algorithm you wanted to use, or like a routine for parsing HTTP headers, was in Python, that person would be less able to comment on that Python implementation of that routine, which is true, but also everybody, you know, there would be a larger number of users, a larger base of users for that library, and so there would be more eyes, and Linus's law would tell us that the bugs would get shallower. So I don't think that things like npm or pip or so on are a great model just because the commonality of language is the reason that these packages are bundled together, not any like, you know, benefit that's provided to either developers or to end users. But also they kind of turn your operating system into a bit of a wild west, because inevitably some of these language specific packages do end up calling through to other implementations that were written in other languages, and then you get a system where you've got, say, Node.js that's being used to build native shared objects to give JavaScript some access to some C++ libraries, but your Python modules also use pip, and then they use setup tools to build the same C++ libraries. But is it the same, or is it a different version? And where are they going? And is one of them ending up in the load path for the other's routines? We don't know. And then your Ruby gems are also building this C++ stuff, and you've got tools which, because they were written in a particular language, are available in that language's repository. So maybe RIMRAF is available in MPF because it was written in JavaScript, but then maybe it's also available in Homebrew because it's an end user tool and someone wanted to contribute it. So when I'm using RIMRAF, where am I getting it from? How do I keep it up to date? The answer quickly becomes, I have this massive recipe of different package managers that I have to go through and keep up to date, but also worry about the compatibility between the packages that they each provide because of the overlap between all of them. Those are the different ideas that go into packaging systems. It's not just about how do I distribute my software and get it to the people who are going to use it. There's also what expectations do those people have? What guarantees do I want to give them about compatibility with other things? Do I want to give compatibility at all, or do I want to give a Flatpak model where I say my app runs entirely on its own and therefore I know it's going to work, but there's absolutely nothing shared? Now, really, in this day and age, what you're losing there is a bit of disk space, because every app would have its own copy of some shared libraries. But these days, shared libraries don't take up a whole lot of either the total amount of storage that's available on a computer or the total amount of storage that's in use when applications are installed, because there's a lot more in terms of graphical assets and data and so on that takes up a much bigger amount of space. So anyway, packages, package managers, and the different philosophies of solidarity or individuality that are encapsulated in those systems. That's it from this episode of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, I would welcome any feedback you have. Comment on the blog or find me on Twitter, iwasleeg, iwasleeg, or send me an email, grahamlee@acm.org. Thank you very much. Talk to you next time.